Okay, so we are heading into Deuteronomy chapter 12, and it's a good time to just briefly resurface and let the commentary tell us where we are in this whole business. Delitzsch says, this begins the second half of this main address from Moses in Deuteronomy. There are three of them. There was an introduction. This is the main body. And then there's a finishing up one. This one consists partly in laws that were not taken care of by the laws of Sinai, because they were traveling through the wilderness and didn't yet have to contemplate what it would mean to be in a settled place. Secondly, some repetition of laws already given. It is divided into three parts. First part is religious and ecclesiastical life. That's chapters 12 through partway through chapter 16. Then the political organization, that'll have to do with laws relating to the king and so on. That's midway through chapter 16 through chapter 18. And then the final one is a whole bunch of things gathered together for how to live a life of religious devotion, not only in the religious part, but also in civil society and with your neighbor. And that will go from 19 through 26. So the second half takes in the bulk of the book. Turn page here. So we come to, that leaves us ready to jump in. So we begin in chapter 12. Oh, by the way, at the end of chapter 12, does everybody have a verse 32 of chapter 12?
Yes.
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 Okay. Nobody has it leaving off after verse 31. There are occasionally spots where the verse division in the Bible differs depending on which translation you have. This is one of them, where some versions end chapter 12 with verse 31, and then verse 32 becomes the first verse of chapter 13. Delitzsch was working with one of those, so that can get confusing. So it's good to make sure that we're all on the, literally all on the same page and same verse. Let's begin. Moses speaking still. These are the statutes and rules that you shall be careful to do in the land that the Lord, the God of your fathers, has given you to possess all the days that you live on the earth. Introduction. Verse 2.
You shall utterly destroy all the places where the nations which you shall dispossess served their gods, on the high mountains and on the hills and under every green tree.
Okay. Note from Delitzsch. For some reason, the heathen nations, the pagan nations, had a thing about worshiping up on mountains and up on hills and under evergreen trees. And the first part of that was because going up higher, they felt they were closer to heaven. The second part of that is under the evergreen tree. Well, evergreen is a, it's a life thing. The power of life and the vigor of the evergreen. Besides which, the dark color of the under the evergreen, Dalek says, lent itself to dispose the mind toward devotion. The nations around would gravitate toward an oak, which attains a great age, the evergreen terebinth, and the poplar, whose deep shade is adapted to dispose the mind to devotion. Don't do that. Do not believe that you ascending up are setting up a place to meet with God. Verse 3 then, you shall tear down their altars and dash in pieces their pillars and burn their asherim with fire. You shall chop down the carved images of their God and destroy their name out of that place. And a reminder again that the worship of the heathen nations included human sacrifice and temple prostitution. The Asherim specifically were closely related with the second of those. The evergreens, closely related to the second of those. Verse 4, this is interesting.
You shall not worship the Lord your God in that way.
Okay, and so you don't set up a high place as if your worshiping God was at your own initiative. You don't set up a place under the evergreens as if you're bringing together the force of life to bring into your worship of God. All that you have is received. Verse 5, but you shall seek the place that the Lord your God will choose out of all your tribes to put his name and make his habitation there. There you shall go. So where was the place that they would, that God would choose to put his name there?
In our hearts?
No, the specific place.
Oh.
The Jerusalem?
The mountain?
Yeah. Ooh. Jerusalem would be that place where it would be the name where God would put his name, because that's the place where he would do the work of salvation. Before Jerusalem, the tabernacle settled in Shiloh. And God apparently, during the time of the judges, set that as the place where they could seek him out. But it is all again and again and again at his initiative. And the worship is to come and receive what God is doing. So, verse 6.
There bring your burnt offerings and sacrifices, your tithes and special gifts, what you have vowed to give, and your free will offerings, and the firstborn of your herds and flocks.
Okay. The things that they would bring there are sacrifices intended for the altar, tithes and heave offerings, which then would involve a fellowship meal in the presence of God. And that's very important. This is God saying, I will join with you in the fellowship meal. And the Israelites were supposed to invite also the priests, the clergy, And we covered this before, but do you remember the reason why they were to invite the priests? The priests were representatives of God himself. So through the priests, God could say, I'm sitting down and eating with you. And all of that points forward in time into the New Testament, where God really would sit down and eat with us. It's true what Luther says. It all points to Jesus. Did we just do verse 6 or?
Yes.
Hadn't done. Okay, so I jumped ahead a little bit. And there you shall eat before the Lord your God, and you shall rejoice, you and your households, in all that you undertake, in which the Lord your God has blessed you. Okay. Verse 8.
You shall not do according to all that we are doing here today, everyone doing whatever is right in his own eyes.
Mm-hmm. For you have not as yet come to the rest and to the inheritance that the Lord your God is giving you. So this is a further focusing in on, this is the pattern that you're called to follow. Verse 10.
But you will cross the Jordan and settle in the land the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, and he will give you rest from all your enemies around you so that you will live in safety.
Then to the place that the Lord your God will choose to make his name dwell there you shall bring all that I command you, your burnt offerings and your sacrifices, your tithes and the contribution that you present, and all your finest vow offerings that you vow to the Lord. Verse 12.
And you shall rejoice before the Lord your God, you and your sons and your daughters, your male servants and the female servants, and the Levite that is within your towns, since he has no portion or inheritance with you.
Okay. Interestingly, God groups the Levite together with the servants and also with the sojourner, by the way, because they didn't have property. And so those who did not have a set place, the inheritance passed from generation to generation, a generation that they could call their own. They were to be welcomed by the Israelites as they brought sacrifices and had fellowship meals and rejoiced before the Lord, because they were to be included in the congregation of Israel. And the congregation then crosses over from the political and secular world into this is religious life. Then brings the question, so what part of life is religious?
All of it.
Yeah. In some way, shape, or form, all of it. Okay, verse 13. Take care that you do not offer your burnt offerings at any place that you see. 14.
But at the place of the Lord that the Lord will choose in one of your tribes, there you shall offer your burnt offerings, and there you shall do all that I am commanding you.
Okay.
So did each tribe have their own place?
No, it was to be the one place. And at first it was Shiloh, and then under King David, with the capture of Jerusalem and the bringing of the ark to Jerusalem and the command to set up the tabernacle in so-and-so's threshing floor, and then the command given under Solomon that God would bless his building of a temple to be a permanent place, because there God would name his name. And in Jerusalem and outside of Jerusalem, there would be the one sacrifice that would be eternal. All of that's in play. They're not to go and offer sacrifices and burnt offerings just anywhere, which means that they'd make a journey to Jerusalem to offer the sacrifices and burnt offerings and bring the tithes and bring the vow offerings. Mm-hmm. Now, what if the tithe included a tenth of your field of melons and you were a 7-day journey from Jerusalem?
Oh, stinky melons. No, you sell them.
And the practical provision was that you would sell them, and the money that you got from them, you would bring to Jerusalem, and there you would buy the equivalent and offer it. What happens if you want to, well, that's the next verse.
Is that the money changers in the temple? Is that how they sprung up?
Well, that would be. It all starts out good, doesn't it?
Yeah, like everything else.
Now, verse 15 is a direct change of something that God told them out in the wilderness. Out in the wilderness, they had been told that any animal that they wished to slaughter, butcher, and eat had to be brought to the temple to do that. And now verse 15, however, you may slaughter and eat meat within any of your towns as much as you desire, according to the blessing of the Lord your God that he has given you. The unclean and the clean may eat of it, as of the gazelle and as of the deer. Handling that from the last phrase back toward the beginning, the gazelle and the deer were animals that were not to be offered at the temple or at the tabernacle. They were still clean for eating, but they couldn't be offered.
Because of the hoof.
So now they have permission to, go hunting and gazelle and deer, and they can have venison and whatnot. But they have also permission to slaughter and eat meat anywhere. So if you are a 5 days journey from Jerusalem, you do not have to take the meat to Jerusalem, slaughter it there, and then transport it back 5 days worth, by which time it's unfit to eat. That would be impractical. So the change is because they're going into the Holy Land, and not only will the boundaries be such and such, but God will extend the boundaries. So it'd be a longer and longer trek to Jerusalem. Verse 16.
But you must not eat the blood, pour it out on the ground like water.
Mm-hmm. And that is maintained from the time of Noah on through the book of Acts, where the apostle said, this is the one thing we want of the Gentiles. Don't do that. Verse 17, you may not eat within your towns the tithe of your grain or of your wine or of your oil or the firstborn of your herd or of your flock or of any of your vow offerings that you vow or your free will offerings or the contribution that you present. Verse 18.
But you shall eat them before the Lord your God, place that the Lord your God will choose, and your son and your daughter, male servants or female servants, Levite who is within your towns, and you shall rejoice before the Lord your God in all that you undertake.
Okay. And take care that you do not neglect the Levite as long as you live in your land. Any questions on that part?
Well, that was kind of a repeat of the verse we just had. So it's different about that.
It's kind of difficult to understand because you're kind of breaking up a little bit. Should we go on? Verse 20.
When the Lord your God enlarges your territory, as he has promised you, and you say, I will eat meat, because you crave meat, you may eat meat whenever you desire.
What do you think? Is Moses getting in just a tiny little dig there?
Because you crave meat.
Yeah. If the place that is the Lord your God, if the place that the Lord your God will choose to put his name there is too far from you, then you may kill any of your herd or your flock which the Lord has given you, as I have commanded you, and you may eat within your towns whenever you desire. He's repeating himself, isn't he? Verse 22.
Just as the gazelle and the deer are eaten, so you may eat them. The unclean and the clean alike may eat them.
Okay. So the gazelle or deer are clean for consumption, but not for offering. And the person who is unclean through whatever, yeah, you remember all of the unclean regulations for the people. If you this, if you that, if you the other thing, you were unclean. But for all of this, for all of the eating meat that is slaughtered distant from Jerusalem, it's okay for them to eat of it. It's not a problem. Um, 23 then. Only be sure that you do not eat the blood, for the blood is the life, and you shall not eat the life with the flesh.
Okay. How can the blood be the life when the animal's dead?
Mm-hmm. Because when the blood is shed, then there is no more life, and the life is in the blood because the blood carries the nutrients through the body, carries the oxygen, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the shedding of blood meant death. And that was as early as with Cain and Abel. The prohibition against taking the stuff of life, taking the life of another human being. With Noah, God allowed the people to shed blood and to eat meat, but not the blood, because what he demanded was a respect for life. It's a very powerful thing in the pattern of teaching. And yes, you could say, you know, the blood isn't the actual life. The life is the stuff that goes on for human beings within the soul. But the blood is that thing that is necessary for life. The heart stops beating, the blood stops flowing, and life ceases. So we're talking about the physical life. What was the comment about jellyfish? They've gotten along perfectly fine for a long, long time without brains, so there's hope for us. I'm sorry.
Now by eating the blood, what? How would you eat the blood?
Mm-hmm. Well, you certain places around the world you drink it.
Oh,
other places okay. You mix it with flour and you cook it into a blood pudding.
All right. That's good. Thank you.
Well, if you don't drain the blood, though, is it kosher meat where they hang the animal and slit the throat? Yeah.
The blood.
So even if you didn't, even if you killed it and didn't drink it, if you cooked it, mm-hmm. you'd still be eating the blood.
Yeah.
Yes, they drain it.
Yeah. As my friend Ed Walter said when he came out to help us when we ran into the deer. He said that our grill had punctured every major organ, so the meat had been drained properly.
That was the best deer, too.
It is good.
Better
venison.
Than most venison we've gotten.
The draining happened really fast.
Uh-huh. Yeah, because it didn't have any. Yeah.
Yeah. But if you've ever gotten a hold of some meat that was not drained properly,
it's not so good.
You know, the taste is not that. It's not.
If you drain it right after it dies, mm-hmm. run hang it immediately and drain it.
Yep. Yep. So when you are hunting, you drain that blood, you field dress it, and then you bring it back. Because you don't want certain things in the animal to affect the meat of the animal.
Right. We did all our own butchering at home farm.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not the wild. I mean, the regular beef and pork. And so.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. Where are we?
24.
Yeah, we did that.
Oh.
So 20, yeah, pour it out on the earth like water. Verse 25, you shall not eat it, that all may go well with you and your children after you when you do what is right in the sight of the Lord. So respecting the life that God has given is one of those things. And I pointed out another part of this, where the Jewish prohibition is not to boil a kid in its mother's milk. And so they will not eat meat and dairy products in the same meal or use the same plates for meat and dairy products. And a couple days after Easter, we were at a Jewish deli in St. Louis. And a guy there asked for cheese on his pastrami sandwich. And kosher he got a deli. Look.
We don't do that here.
We don't do that.
But he could eat all the baked goods that they had.
Yeah.
No milk.
Yeah. So I went nuts on the bakery section.
Yeah, then. He bought bakery. And then we went back the next day and bought more bakery and brought it home. Because he could eat it all.
Yeah. But the purpose there was to mark out a section of the creation as a picture of mercy. The mother and the child within the womb, the mother and the nursing child, is the picture that God plants into his creation so that with the animals, the Jews were told, don't do that. You're stepping on mercy, basically. Mm-hmm. Isaiah 49 verses, is it 16 and 17? I might have it memorized by now where to find it. But tremendously important lesson, because if you violate mercy, what is left? That's the heart and the core that is underlying the gospel, and you violate what underlies the gospel, do you then understand, perceive, see the whole business of mercy when it comes to you in the cross? Don't compromise those things. Mark them off and say off limits. So with the eating of blood, mark it off and say off limits. Shall we go on? Verse 26.
But the holy things that are due from you and your vow offerings, you shall take, and you shall go to the place that the Lord will choose.
Yeah. Come to God's house. Why God's house? Because there is where he sets up the whole business of mercy. And offer your burnt offering, the flesh and the blood on the altar of the Lord your God. The blood of your sacrifices shall be poured out on the altar of the Lord your God, but the flesh you may eat. Verse 28.
Observe and obey all these words which I command you, that it may go well with you and your children after you forever, when you do what is good and right in the sight of the Lord your God.
Okay. So it will eventually come to Jerusalem, this whole business of the mercy of God. And there at Jerusalem, the people of God will see the mercy of God played out outside the city on a hill called Calvary. And this is the whole thing. God is setting up, leading in that direction. And then a caution. Verse 29, when the Lord your God cuts off before you the nations whom you go in to dispossess, and you dispossess them and dwell in their land. Verse 30.
Take care that you be not ensnared to follow them after they have been destroyed before you, and that you do not inquire about their gods, saying, how did these nations serve their gods, that I also may do the same?
All over in the ancient world, they had a concept of the God, the people, the land, and the three holding together, so that there were gods of this territory, gods of that territory, gods of another territory. And if your nation was dispossessed and had to move to another area of the world, you would ask, how do the local native gods want things done? And because we have to appease and please the local native gods, because there were forces of nature gods in different areas of the world. And force of nature gods meant that there was an interweaving between the god and the force of nature that was there, exhibited in the growth of the vegetation, the hills, the whatnot, and the people coming in would then try and connect with these things. Let me make this relevant for the New Testament. So when the northern kingdom was displaced and went off someplace else, the Assyrians took groups of people from different areas of the ancient world and brought them in to resettle that land. Things started to go badly. And those people that were resettling that land then sent back to king or emperor and said, things are going badly. We need to know how to please the God of this land. And so they gathered some of the Jewish teaching and sent it to them. And they began to follow the Jewish religious practices as a way of pleasing the god of that land, which is a totally pagan idea. And the name of that group that did that is the Samaritans. Do some things click into place? So you have the Good Samaritan, the parable. You have the woman at the well. You have Jesus traveling through the territory of the Samaritans, and there's some opposition. And after the resurrection, Jesus tells his disciples, you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem, Judea,
and Samaria,
and to the ends of the earth. So the Jewish people going in were not to inquire about, oh, the gods of that territory, because God is God. And the whole idea of force of nature gods, just do not follow that path at all. Okay, verse 30. Oh, no, that was red, wasn't it?
Yes.
31, you shall not worship the Lord your God in that way. For every abominable thing that the Lord hates, they have done for their gods. For they even burn their sons and their daughters in the fire to their gods. Which is why they'd crossed the line and needed to be eliminated, because you cannot say, this is what God this wants. You are slandering the name of God by using the word God and doing this kind of thing. 32.
Everything that I command you, you shall be careful to do. You shall not add to it or take from it.
Okay. Now let's go into more cautions and how do you navigate your way through religion. 13 verse 1, if a prophet or a dreamer of dreams arises among you and gives you a sign or a wonder. So wait, there are prophets and dreamers and vision seers, and they can perform signs of wonder. And Jesus said at the end, there would be signs and wonders to, if possible, lead even the elect astray. So signs and wonders are never disputed in the Bible that there are signs and wonders. But what do you make of them? Verse 2.
And if the sign or wonder of which he has spoken takes place, and he says, let us follow other gods, gods you have not known, and let us worship them.
Oh, so a false prophet might do an actual sign or wonder, and it might actually happen. It's possible. Well, because there are spiritual forces that are not good spiritual forces, aren't there? What do you do then?
Think how popular Gene Dixon was back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
Who's Gene Dixon?
She was supposedly
a prophet
who predicted certain things like the end of the world and the coming of the Man of Peace.
And the death of John Kennedy, that was how she got her fame, was she predicted that John Kennedy would be assassinated, JFK would be assassinated.
How many other people did she predict would get assassinated?
But anyway, she was real pop. Those of you who are of my age or older probably remember her, right?
Oh, I can tell you how to get a prophecy that happens every day. Wake up in the morning and tell your family that you dreamed that something bad would happen. And then just wait. There will be a day. And then you can say, yeah, I told you, I dreamed it. Yeah.
Anyway.
What do you do with this? They're apparently prophets and they tell of a sign and it happens. What do you do? Verse 3, you shall not listen to the words of that prophet or that dreamer of dreams, for the Lord your God is testing you to know whether you love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. So in the last part of that verse, he's going back to Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 4 and 5, because this is standard teaching. You have a body of teaching that has been attested by God with his own words, with signs and wonders, but you know those signs and wonders are from God. So those are locked in and secure. You don't have to listen to all of these other things. You have a core of teaching. Hold to that. That's the theme that Delitzsch will be setting up in the next, large number of verses. You have a core of teaching. You're excluded from having to try and figure out whether the prophet is a true prophet just because the vision he had came to pass, when he's telling you things that violate your core teaching. There were those in the 1800s in our country who would have done better to remember that when a certain prophet arose and decided that he was going to teach wild things and claimed that visions and signs and wonders were happening. The signs and wonders are irrelevant if the teaching violates what you know to be true. Let's take in another verse. Verse 4.
You shall walk after the Lord your God and fear him and keep his commandments and obey his voice. You shall serve him and hold fast to him.
Okay. So you know that the Lord is one. You know that you are to serve the Lord and him only. You know that you are to have no other gods. So he comes along and he generates all these signs and amazing things and tells you there's another God that we can serve. There's something rotten in Denmark. Is that how the phrase goes?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or I smell a rat. Verse 5, but that prophet or that dreamer of dreams shall be put to death because he has taught rebellion against the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt and redeemed you out of the house of slavery, to make you leave the way in which the Lord your God commanded you to walk, so you shall purge the evil from your midst. Now, this does not apply to somebody from outside coming in and saying, oh, let me tell you about this God Baal. He's not of the people of God trying to turn the people of God away from God. So it is specific. It doesn't mean go off and kill anybody who doesn't agree with you. But for the people of Israel in that time, in that place, where there were so many other religions happening all around them and could lead them into things like child sacrifice, this could be bad stuff. Okay, verse 6. Second case, what if it's not just the prophet down the street? verse 6.
If your brother, the son of your mother, or your son or your daughter, or the wife you embrace, or your friend who is as your own soul, entices you secretly saying, let us go and serve other gods, which neither you nor your fathers have known.
Yeah, that brings it close. Some of the gods of the peoples who are around you, whether near you or far off from you, from the one end of the earth to the other, verse 8.
You shall not yield to him or listen to him, or shall your eye pity him, or shall you spare him, or shall you conceal him.
Mm-hmm. But you shall kill him. In our day, we do excommunication.
It's nicer than stoning.
Which is legitimate for somebody in the congregation that says, oh, wait a minute, let me propose that we don't just believe in God, we have another God too. No. Okay.
In today's society, would atheism almost be like, you know, a god? Because so many have turned to that, saying there is no god, and therefore that makes them god. That's like a god of self.
And the Jews never pursued those who had simply lost their faith. It was specific other gods. So that would probably be a no.
That would be a no for that. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because you don't hear, well, I guess you do. Never mind. Mm-hmm. You know, they suddenly wanted to be Buddhists or,
but,
you know, some other religion.
But, you know, and indeed there are people that chase after science as if it was God's.
Right.
Carl Sagan, billions and billions and billions of years. And part of the corruption happens when science wanders into religion. And a scientist will begin to say things like, science proves that there is no God. And a scientist begins to propose that science can speak to moral and ethical basic questions. That's out of bounds. Science is the study of the natural world to figure out how it works.
So that you can turn around and say, wow, what an amazing God.
Well, science is supposed to be neutral in all of that. Does gravity exist?
Yeah, but who created it? It's
the scientist's purview to determine the operation of gravity. And to refuse to step into, what does that mean?
But there's a lot of scientists who are Christian.
There are a lot of scientists who are Christian. Scientists
and seeing the wonders of creation.
In fact, Christianity is what gave rise to science.
That's what I was saying. Because
what Christianity did was say the world is predictable and not governed by fickle and capricious force of nature gods. So it is predictable that if you jump off this four-story building, you will go down. Under the Greek gods, that was not necessarily so. There were no set rules for how the universe worked. And Christianity comes along and says, there is a pattern in God's creation. And the scientists at that point say, cool, now let's figure it out. Which, so far as that goes, is quite legitimate. Where it gets out of hand is something like if Darwin says things evolved, therefore there is no God. What? First off, things evolved is a statement of a thesis, and every thesis is to be tested. Secondly, we'll go back to firstly in a moment. Secondly, to cross over and say, this proves that, is completely outside of the bounds of science. As far as thesis is concerned, I just read a thing on Babylon Bee that said, scientists all over the world are out of work because the science is settled. Therefore, there is no more knowledge to be gained, and all of what we know cannot be contradicted by further evidence. So they're all out of work.
Oh, brother.
Which they run a sarcastic.
It's a sarcasm site.
It's like
write
the Onion.
Funny stories.
It's like the Onion. But the point is taken, science is not settled. I had a science teacher that in class said, what will happen if I let go of this eraser? It'll fall to the earth. And he says, no, that's not science. Science says that all of the times up to this point, this is what has happened. If, however, I let go of this eraser and it doesn't, then we have to go back and modify our thesis. His point was that the role of science is to make observations, to create theses, to test them, always with the possibility that you may run into the evidence that contradicts it, and then you have to go back and you have to make your adjustment. The laws of gravitation that were determined by Isaac Newton. Well, guess what? They were inaccurate. In a very fine point, the orbit of planets and moons and et cetera, does not fit exactly how Newton figured it. There was a variation that was discovered, and so the theory has been modified.
Did we just lose Debbie?
I think so. Norma? Yeah, a couple people dropped. We go on with the survivors. What? That's... don't want to hear that. So... let's see, verse 9, I didn't finish. Your hand shall be first against him to put him to death, and afterward the hand of all the people. Which sounds like a verse you just passed by. However, there was a rule set up from that point that it was the witnesses who would be the first to cast the stone. And does that come into play in John chapter 8 with the woman caught in adultery? And Jesus says, let he who is without sin among you cast the first stone. Which in that case would disqualify the witness. And then what does he say to her? Has no one condemned you? No, sir. neither do I. What is he setting himself up as when he says, neither do I?
Forgiving her sins.
More basic even than that. The word begins
ultimate
with
judge. The judge, judging.
No. Yeah. The word begins with a W.
Witness.
The witness. So let he who is without sin among you cast the first stone. But here, let the witness cast the first stone, which means I know what you did. Are you looking for people coming back on?
Well, no, I'm just wondering. Okay, so we lost Mike, we lost Debbie, and we lost Norma. Did we lose anybody else, or is that it?
I don't know.
I'm wondering if there was a power surge or something.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
But Jesus claims the place of being the witness who has the right. Huh. Neither do I, go and sin no more. He does confront. Verse 11. Oh. Did we do verse 10?
No.
Do verse 10.
You shall stone him to death with stones because he sought to draw you away from the Lord your God, and he brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery.
And all Israel shall hear and fear and never again do any such wickedness as this among you. There is a third case. Verse 12.
If you hear someone in one of your cities, which the Lord your God gives you to dwell in, saying
that certain worthless fellows have gone out among you and have drawn away the inhabitants of their city, saying, let us go and serve other gods which you have not known. Verse 14.
Then you must inquire, probe, and investigate it thoroughly. And if it is true, and it has been proved that this detestable thing has been done among you.
Why do you need to check it out so carefully? Otherwise, somebody wants to wipe out a rival city, they'll just spread a rumor.
Yeah.
Yeah. You shall surely put the inhabitants of that city to the sword, devoting it to destruction, all who are in it and its cattle with the edge of the sword. Verse 16.
Gather all the Go ahead.
And you shall gather all its plunder into the middle of the street and completely burn with fire the city and all its plunder for the Lord your God. It shall be a heap forever. It shall not be built again.
Whoa. Did that ever happen? No. None of the devoted things shall stick to your hand that the Lord may turn from the fierceness of his anger and show you mercy and have compassion on you and multiply you as he swore to your fathers. However, Achan, he and his household were put to death by taking the plunder of, what city did they take the plunder of? Regardless. Verse 18.
Because you obey the Lord your God, keeping all his commandments that I am giving you today and doing what is right in his eyes.
Okay. And we should finish there. These are rules that have to do with a significant severity. because the turning away from God is something that can lead to the death of the nation. And I'll finish with that.